Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 2, delivered on January 22, 2018. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Today, special topics, the Federal Reserve. Interesting part of this lecture is why I'm doing this as a special topic. You see, very few finance textbooks cover the Federal Reserve. Now, that's not an oversight. There is this belief in American way of teaching business that the government is superfluous, or it's a burden, or it's just something that's in the way, instead of a central part of a functioning modern Western industrial economy. As such, to talk about the Federal Reserve would be to concede that the Federal Reserve has a huge impact on financial markets. And going on from there, well, if we admit or concede that the Federal Reserve is a major influence on the economy of the United States, then we face the question of what would happen if we removed that? Would the economy survive? Why did we have it in the first place? Is there some reason why we still keep these kinds of institutions? Maybe we're all too modern. We don't need that anymore, any more than we need horses, any more than we need a hand crank on the front of our car. Maybe the Federal Reserve is unnecessary. I'm not going to get too far into that, but we'll address it far enough that you can use your developing and well-developed considerations to decide for yourself on that. Before I get too far into this, though, I do want to make one last pass at what finance is. Finance, I said it is a subdiscipline of economics, but there's more to it than that. Do I have any finance majors in here? Well, I'll try to turn some of you, more of you into the dark side if I possibly can as the semester goes along. By the end of this course, I'm hoping that you'll all major in finance. Okay, maybe not all of you, but in fact, finance as a field, as a career choice, actually has a lot of different parts to it. You could get into investments. That's buying and selling stocks. That is the one that is the least likely to be a good idea, because there are literally tens of thousands of unemployed in the industry who have been moved out. More will be swept aside as the artificial intelligence systems put their teeth into this industry and they start making the decisions instead of humans. You would at best be a front pretty face in much of this. And if you go into investments, the idea, well, I'm going to get a job on Wall Street or something like that, no. No, the Ivy League good old boys network is going to make sure that the families that have always been there will stay there with the next generation. You could be the greatest hot shot in the world, and it probably won't do a whole lot of good. I was in that world. I saw the kinds of people in that world. They are quite something. Very few of you have the personality types, and you should be glad for that to be in here. However, it's there for you if you want to take your shot. Well, I do day trading at home, so I'm really ready. No, you're not. You have no idea. I was in that world. It is just something unbelievable. We have a financial planning institute right here at ISU. It is relatively new, and right away it got a lot of notice. It is a good career choice, and there is almost unlimited upside potential for income, but you really have to work hard. And the idea that you'll go in the back room and be one of the technical people, that's very unlikely. Most likely you would be a salesman. You would be selling financial products, and you wouldn't be selling them to mom and dad. You would be selling them to rich people. In other words, you would not come to me. You would come to Mr. Wealthy Family over there, or Ms. I Made a Fortune in Selling Weird Products on the Internet. Okay, you wouldn't bother with me. You cater to the upper middle class and the upper class. And you have to beat the streets, pound the pavements, but at the same time, I have a former student he won't tell me how much he's making because he's afraid I'll call him things that start with mother. He's just so wealthy now, but he literally was walking the streets around this area of Illinois, just putting his card, giving it, just consider me. If you ever have a question or if you want have a little extra money, I know you all probably already have a financial planner. You're taking other people's business oftentimes, and they're not going to give in to you if you just walk up to them. They might start with a little bit of money trying you out, and then you have to prove yourself to them. But at the same time, boy, there's a lot of money in this business. Okay, financial planning. Another one, we have a program. We have a school here. The Cady School of Insurance is in the top three in the nation. The director is a good friend of mine, Jim Jones. We've gone out and eaten at a very bad restaurant outside of town. He is known all over the world. This school is known all over the world. To give you an idea of how powerful insurance is as a career, we are projecting 500,000 jobs are going to go wanting in the next 5 to 7 years. Why? Because they hired all these people in the insurance industry in the 60s and 70s. Oh, we got all we need. And they didn't keep going with that. And now suddenly all of those people are retiring and they are really, really hard up. And it's not just selling mom and pop insurance. We're talking about international commercial insurance. They got all kinds of programs and the industry is throwing money to get people into the industry and keep them in the industry. Insurance is commercial brokering, risk management. Those kinds of high-powered fields are just desperate for people. Trust me on that. I know that for a fact. Okay, now, other ones. Real estate. Real estate finance was one of my specialties. There's always going to be a need for real estate finance people. The crunchers of the numbers who can figure out, yes, we're going to buy this apartment complex. No, we're not going to buy that strip mall. That inside mall, well, we'll buy it, we'll tear it down, we'll do the finance. Yeah, it's worth it for us to tear it down and make an open mall, an open space shopping center. Oh, those are going out of style now, so let's go back and look at some of these places where we could tear down buildings and put up a new inside shopping mall. It's all about that. Buildings, houses, rental, and I'm not talking about people who sell houses. I'm talking about real estate at the big level. That's a really big one. Another one right now that is going to keep growing is institutional finance. And that is the one that is the subject of this lecture today. Institutional finance is banks, credit unions, things like that, where people who have money are matched with people who need money. What we call surplus economic units are matched with deficit economic units. And institutional finance, the problem is oftentimes you start kind of low. You might start as a teller, but if you've got drive, ambition, and you're not afraid to push at the system, you can go pretty far in institutional finance. It's a great challenge, huge upside opportunities, but there's also a lot of challenges in there. We're going to talk about that on Wednesday when I get to ethics, because the banks are some of the hotbeds of corruption and bad, bad, unethical behavior. There's finance. And there are other ones. One that I've been trying to get them to talk about here, even just to talk about it in classes, and they're not ready to talk about it yet. But I can take you to places, and with my club, I'm trying to get some arrangements to take you to a couple of places up in Chicago. This one, sports finance. I'm not talking about streams of money. I'm not even talking about rivers of money. I'm talking about oceans and seas of money. Everything is entertainment. Money flows like, it's just amazing the amount of money that is moving through one sports team, one athlete, and that's finance, how you get it done. Okay, we want that athlete. How much is it going to cost us to do that? What are the risks? Okay, if he gets injured in season one, season two, we're stuck with this, with a contract for 10 years. How do we finance this? How do we do this kind of work? I took my students up to the raceway in Joliet. They laid it out for them. Okay, the whole thing here is that we have to get butts in the seats at this price per seat in order for us to survive from one day to the next. Okay, we've got some drag racers. I got a drag racer, he used to be an ISU alum. He was calculating how many more seasons he had to drag to be able to get out of the business and live the rest of his life, because there was a risk every time he took off from that starting line. That might be the last time, because as every time you start off from the starting line, your retina is detached a little more. And so he's got to try to get to the end and get enough money so that he can finance the rest of his life before that one where he sees the green and then he sees black as he goes down the drag strip. Sports finance. Okay, we've got a little podunk team here in this area. How could that be surviving? Okay, let's find out where the advertisers are. Let's tell them what this is. What you put your advertisements here, and you give us this much money to pay our athletes and to keep the stadium maintained. That's sports finance. It's all very cool, and unfortunately, we're still not talking about very much here. But I took my students up to the White Sox Stadium a few years back. That was pretty amazing seeing that. But institutional finance. This gets us back to banks. This gets us back to the ideas of what banks are to begin with. Banks match surplus and deficit economic units. You see, the problem, though, is that banks left to their own devices will be left to the devices of the people who run them. And unfortunately, as is the case in most of the world where there's money, that money is going to attract very dark kinds of people. The kinds of people who are going to do whatever they can to make a buck, and how much other people suffer, well, that's going to be a problem, because those people are on their own without any, if we have a free market with no regulation. We started off trying to have a first national bank in this country with the founding of the country. And then we had this rabble-rousing president who was promised, I'm going to get rid of these banks, this national bank, and let the market take care of itself. And he made that a rallying cry, and all of the people in the country who were against big government in the early 1800s stood behind him, and so the charter expired, and we were in the world of just private enterprise, free market, the libertarian dream running the banks. Well, they had their agenda, and that was one of the major reasons that the South was so bitter at the North. Because those bankers up on the East Coast, along with those shippers, those merchants up there on the East Coast, were making sure that everything worked in their advantage and nothing was working down in the Southern states. And every time you talked about another government regulation, well, those Southern state people, they said, yeah, you've really done us a lot of good, setting up tariffs that kill us, making sure that those bankers are building railroads and industrial centers up in the North. Yeah, that's a real good idea for you to tell us about government. And so it sets the stage for a great deal of bitterness that still stands to this day. I can go down to my relatives down in Kentucky and Tennessee, and there's places you probably wouldn't want to go if you're a Fed. The banks were screwing people over. And all of these scams were running rampant, and there wasn't anything anyone could do about it. A good example of that was after the Civil War. A fine man, General Ulysses S. Grant, he became president. And once he was done with that, he wanted to have something to do with his life. And so these con artists got his ear, and they said, we're going to set up this investment plan. And why don't you tell all those veterans in the who respect you so much to invest their pensions in our investment plan. We'll give you an office, General Grant. We will give you cigars, President Grant. We will make you a part of our organization as the face of our wonderful investment opportunity. Oh, it was a complete scam. Those guys took off with all the money, left those veterans of the Civil War poor as dirt, no money at all. Crippled, broken, PTSD before they had such a nonsense term, you name it. The unbelievable thing, though, is that Grant was dying of throat cancer, and he went to the woods to be alone to write his book, and he sat on the porch, wrapped in blankets as he wrote. Streams of veterans from Civil War, day and night, going by. The men he had unintentionally screwed. You know why they went by? So they could salute the general. Because that's what you do. The banks in the 1870s, once the Civil War was over, the northern banks were just having the heyday. They were having the time of their life. One scam after another scam after another scam. Sir, I'm going to ask you if you will invest $10,000 and I will give you $20,000 back in 1 year.
Yes.
Good man. I knew you were the kind of guy who would do this kind of business deal with me. Now, ma'am, I'm going to ask you if you will lend me $30,000 and I will pay you back $60,000 in 1 year.
Yes.
Damn. Here's your $20,000. Oh, my God. Tell everyone. Okay, now, ma'am, I'm going to ask you to lend me $100,000 and in 1 year I'll get you back $200,000. Here's your money back. And I put a bunch of it in my pocket. Now I don't have any for you, so I got to go to you. $500,000, and I'll get you $1 million in a year. Well, of course you will. So I'm going to take that and give you yours back, put more in my pocket. Does anyone know what that's called? It's called a pyramid scheme. They were all over the place. There was no rule. There was no law enforcement agency that would deal with it. The way we finally figured out how to do things is we'd make a law. Don't do this. And then, for businesses. And then what we would do is set up an agency that would oversee regulation by that law. But this was before they did that. So even if there were laws, who was going to prosecute? Were you going to have in the 1880s some marshal go out and try to stand up to those bad boys? Trust me, when there's millions of dollars involved, these people will kill. And that's true. That was true back then. It's been true all throughout history. It's true to this day. In my consulting work, I found that out. I thought, well, that can't really be. Oh, yeah, it is. So you see, stopping this was going to be a major problem. And then we had the next problem that started in the 1880s. And it was like a cycle. It kept happening. You see, when a bank takes money. Okay. Madam. You are sleeping one night and you are in a restful state, and then all of a sudden this glowing light shines over you and you hear angels. Hosanna. And here comes this man with long hair. My child, you have done well. Here is $1,000 for you. Okay. And then he floats back. Hosanna. And he disappears. Well, you got $1,000. Out of nowhere. We call that the autonomous injection, the base, M0. Okay, so you rush to your bank right here. And you put that money in the bank. Deposit. $1,000. Now that's the M, the initial, the autonomous injection. Okay, now you are a bank. Obviously, you have to make money. So what you would do is take her money and invest it, lend it. But you've got to have to keep some because she might come in and ask for some of it. She might write a check to someone and you'd have to honor that check. So you're going to have to keep a fractional reserve on it. So let's say that you keep a fractional reserve of, 20%. So you're going to keep $200. But that means that you have $800 lendable that you can actually make interest off. Well, this young, fine, strapping young man comes to you and says, I have a business deal. I want to borrow money to start my own male escort service.
For sure.
Indeed.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Cougar bait. Well, you say, I've got $800. He says, that'll do it. So you start it. You hire this guy to write your code for the on Snapchat and Omegle to free mollies with your first purchase. Oh, how nasty is that? Yeah. So you get it. He pays you the $800. You go back to the bank and put it in the bank. Well, spank me. Look at this. The bank has another $800 in the reserves plus the $1,000 it had on its books before. You might be thinking to yourself, now, wait a minute here, Sparky. Don't call me Sparky. This can't work. Yes, it does. Okay. So you have to keep 20% of that, which would be $160, which leaves you with $640. And you come there. Yeah. I want to make Assassin's Creed a real thing on the dark web. It scares the hell out of me. You look like you could do it, too. Well, you go to the banker. Well, I got $640. Well, that'll work. So you set it up. You hire a couple of people to shoot people. It's not murder. You just shoot them in the hind leg. Okay, it won't kill him, but it'll hurt like hell. So, okay, so you give him the 640. He comes back to your bank, and he puts in 640 deposit. And there's 20% of that, which is $128. And this is where the math, I start really tanking here. I'm so bad at math. I taught it for years. I messed up so many people. $512. Yeah, there. Do you see what's happening? There's a multiplier effect coming down the line on the original deposit. It's growing on its own. That's how the banking system works. Now, by the way, at the end of this deposit, this will keep rolling around and around. In a simple world, and there, it can be a little more complicated if there's people keep some cash in their pocket. But the basic idea is this. Look. The total amount of money, the change in the money supply, total change in the money supply is going to be the initial amount put in times 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, it'd be $1,000 times 1 over 0.20. So the multiplier is 5 on the 1,000. So ultimately, at the end of the day, that one deposit of $1,000 created $5,000 of new money in the economy. $5,000 worth of new money in the economy. Now, you'll notice something interesting here is that if the reserve requirement is higher, that slows the growth of this multiplier. If the multiplier is lower, that accelerates the growth. One of the jobs of the Federal Reserve is to set that required reserve ratio, to put it at a place where it's in a balance. Banks need to keep money in their vault. They really do need to. But at the same time, they've got to have they got to make a living. They've got to have enough money to. And someone actually asked me, it's been like 5-6 years ago in an econ class, well, what is the required reserve ratio right now, Professor C? And I'm looking at him kind of, I guess it's about 5%. I don't know. So after the class the next day, I called a former fellow PhD student of mine who was working at St. Louis Federal Reserve. And I asked him, what is the multiplier? I said, I talk about it all the time, but I actually don't know what it is. And he said, which one? Duh. And I said, what? You mean there's more than one? He said, yeah. He said, it depends on how much money you're talking about. They use the term tranche, T-R-A-N-C-H-E, tranche, it's basically a pile of money. So he said, the first $10 million tranche, I think it is. And then there's a tranche, there's a reserve ratio for that one. Then there's a tranche for 10 to 50 million, I think it was, a required reserve ratio. And then there's a ratio for 50,000 and up. 50 million, I'm sorry, million and up. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, so in other words, the larger the bank, the more reserve that top tier of money has. That has to stay in the vault, basically. And I said, okay, well, what's the tranche at the top? And he gave me some, I think it was like, at the time, it was like 6.28%, and the middle one was 3.5%. And then the one that blew me away, well, what's the tranche at the bottom for the small banks? Zero. They have no requirement to hold money in the vault. They do, but they have no requirement to. I thought that was weird. I said, why would you have a zero? Why are they not required to hold some? He said, it's basically, we're talking about with that tranche of money, and I think it was 10 million. He said, you're talking about community banks. You're talking about small banks that we want to aggressively lend into the community. And we would assume that they have they're more likely to be accountable and to be willing to behave properly than larger banks would. It was some argument like that. Now, we know that that's to some extent true, but we also know that small banks do have a tendency sometimes to get unbalanced in the lending they do, and I'll talk about that a little later in the course, some of the enforcement problems that have happened, especially in this area of the country in recent years. Okay, there you go. Well, here was the trick that was going on. Banks were not, in the 1880s, keeping enough money in their vault. So it came to the point where someone like you would go into the bank and say, I should like $800 of my money back. And they say, well, I don't have it. And you would slap the crap out of him and say, where's my money? He was immediately dead. You're gone. You're toast. And so all the other depositors hear, he couldn't give her money. They go running and give me my money. Oh, I don't have it. Give me my money. Oh, I don't have it. And there would be a run on the bank. The bank would just fold like a house of cards. Kaboom, like that. But it was worse than that because once that banker had failed, you have a bank right across the street. And people are going to say, no, wait a minute. He failed. Let me see. Give me all my money. Hey, you guys who have deposits here, let's all go in and see if she's got our money. Now, she might have good reserves, but if everyone comes in at once, she folds right there. A good bank gets a boom, like that. And then your bank down the street, everyone runs your bank, and you get a cascading effect, and a whole bunch of banks in the neighborhood just kaboom together. This was happening all over the place in the 1880s. And then There was the dirty trick that was also done in the 1920s as well. You are evil. Mm-hmm. You are a genius. You know how to start a rumor. So what you do is you start a rumor that her bank doesn't have the money to pay, give people their money from deposits. You get a whole bunch of people who have deposits there to believe it at the same time. They'll all go to her bank. And of course you won't have it for all of them. It's a fractional reserve. You cause her bank to die in an hour. And then you step in and buy up for pennies on the dollar. That was done by the rich families that later became reputable in the 1880s and 1890s and then in the 1920s again. They would simply start media rumors that a bank was in trouble. And even if the bank isn't in trouble, they could destroy the bank. Simply doing that. And then they'd come in and buy the banks, and then they would consolidate market power in the banking industry, in a neighborhood, in a city, in a state, in the nation. All of this was getting, I mean, look, back in that era, it wasn't much different from what it is now. Our government was the best government money could buy. I mean, politicians were decided who was going to be running for office, who was going to be elected, were decided in back rooms, literally the cigar smoke-filled back room with the old boys. And the politicians were of no mind to cross these rich, powerful people who were profiting from this kind of problem. Until it got to the point where these microeconomic problems with banks failing started becoming macroeconomic recessions from too many banks failing at once. The recessions were deep, long, and they just irritated the hell out of people. At that time, the first movements of socialism were taking hold in the United States, and there was a serious interest by the unions, which had socialist leanings, had a good talking point. Do you really want these big government, big business, big government people running your lives, workers of the world, unite? You have nothing to lose but your chains. And that kind of rabble-rousing, that kind of dissent, that kind of unionization, that kind of anger at the populist sentiment, along with a few politicians who played the populist line very well, the government began to pay attention. They didn't pay attention really until about 1913. You see, in Western Europe, central banks or the proto-central banks had been coming up since the late 1600s. By the time you got to the 1800s, Western Europe had central banks. Every country had a central bank. A bank that was the bank of the banks, that watched the banks, that was ruled and regulated by the Congress directly. We just sat on our fat butts saying free markets, laissez-faire, until it got to the point where laissez-faire was tearing the country apart economically. So in the second decade of the 1900s, we finally passed the Federal Reserve Act. Which essentially established a central bank in the United States. They divided the country into 12 regions called districts. Each district would have a district bank. The center of this system would be overseen by 7 governors who would be appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the Senate. 7 governors. Now, one of them would be the chairman. Don't ever let me trick you on a quiz or an exam or something like that. There are 7 governors plus 1 chairman. No, the chairman is one of the 7. There have been great governors, there have been sort of less great. The recent years have seen some kind of lame ones, more political. But keep in mind that many of these men and women are the cream of the crop. There was always a problem with diversity, which is now being overcome in the governor's ranks. As a matter of fact, right now, the chairman is a chairwoman, Janet Yellen. And she's fairly good at her job, although she's just overwhelmed by what's happening these days. Now, the district bank, each district bank has a bank president. Now, these guys are the cream of the crop. I've met two of these in my life. These people are just consummate. They have their degrees are in accounting, finance, economics. They never break laws. They are ethical as hell. I don't think they even have sex. They're just, I mean, it's almost like you back away from them. You're introduced and I'm not worthy of your contempt kind of people. They're very powerful and they have very different political opinions. Right now, they're kind of unified in their opinion of politically on one matter. But they have different, some of them are conservatives. They don't almost never have an extremist of right wing or leftist. You have some who are slightly conservative or some who are slightly liberal, but you don't get what you see in the normal world with these screamers on both sides. These guys, they see everything as business. Let not your politics get involved in cold business decision making. Well, seven governors, 12 district bank presidents, each one overseeing his district. Now, interestingly enough, each of these banks makes money, creates money. That business of yours, I got this person, it's really been annoying lately. I mean, his dog goes outside and piddles and then barks at me. And one night I mooed at the dog and the dog almost attacked me. Okay, what does that say right there?
The A right there.
That's an A. Okay. What does it say in the little circle around it?
It says Bank of Boston.
Boston. Mm-hmm. It's the Bank A. Each one of them has, you'll see that they're all around here. Here. Yeah. I got a Denny's tonight. Grand Slam. No, seriously, noob, look at this. And I've even got a tip for that waitress who, she smiles at me when I give her a tip. What's this one?
That's an L.
And what is the bank?
Bank of San Francisco.
San Francisco. San Francisco's got a problem. You see, when these districts were first made, they made the ones on the East Coast real small geographically because that's where all the action was. The ones on the West Coast were these giant regions. Well, unfortunately, now San Francisco District Bank is just up to its ears in work because the West Coast developed. And it's got this huge region geographically to oversee. By the way, the bank in New York is called the Empire Bank. It's a very special bank. And I'll tell you why that is here in a moment. But the Empire Bank is a kind of special bank. Now, the governors regulate. In other words, the laws are written, and then the governors write regulations interpreting the law for businesses to comply with. The district banks supervise. They take the regulations and they go out to the banks in their area and they supervise compliance. So the board regulates and the district banks supervise. I, as a personal note here, I try every few years to take my finance club students to one of the central banks. There's one up in Chicago, and there's one down in St. Louis. Interestingly, we're near the border between the two districts. We're in the Chicago, but I think it's like only about 40 miles south of here, the banks would be in the St. Louis. Now, quite honestly, St. Louis Bank is awesome. They just rolled out the red carpet. They are known as the education bank. They do a lot of things like learning materials for schools. They have video games, for heaven's sakes. They have animations. I'm going to put up on my website, isu-prof.com, a short 15-minute cartoon version of some of what I'm telling you here. I mean, it's cheesy, it's stupid, but it covers the basics, and they do all that kind of stuff. They were really great to us down there. And I mean, they had heavy-duty economists and some of the big people from the St. Louis Fed talked to my students, and they were literally almost like throwing jobs and internships. Do this, do that. You know, we'd love to have you. And I don't want to live in St. Louis. Yeah, okay, whatever. And they even offered a couple of them jobs, and unfortunately, the young people found jobs in Chicago paying less, and they still took those instead. The Federal Reserve System, if you work for them, they'll pay for the rest of your education clear through a PhD. You'd have access to the largest databases in the world, so your dissertation would not be a real hard thing. Now, the Chicago one, that's a different animal. I took my students there once, and I just took them in. They have this display room where you can see $1 million, you can see money being shredded and all that. And I mean, they were just downright mean. There was this big security guard at the front, and she made my students walk in single file into that exhibit room. And I'm at the back, and as soon as I got there, she hits me on the knuckles. She said, "No, you stay here." And you go, "Ow, damn, woman, that hurt." God. We had drinks later. Great girl. They just didn't, you want to see our operations kind of thing. It was just like they were much more closed up than the other one was. But anyway, they are heavy-duty, powerful institutions. Now remember, there are 7 governors, 12 district banks. Now, there is a very important committee of the Federal Reserve. They have a lot of committees, but one of them affects the economy quite strongly. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. This is the committee that decides on the direction of short-term interest rates. They set some, they set some, and the ones that they can't set, they try their best to affect. Now, the FOMC makes decisions. We're going to increase the money supply to drive down interest rates, or we're going to hold the money supply constant to keep interest rates where they are, or we're going to decrease the money supply to raise interest rates. So the FOMC has the 7 governors as 7 of its 12 members. And then from the 12 district banks, 5 are chosen on 2-year rotating basis. Except one of them is permanent. One of them is permanent. That's the Empire Bank president. He is always has a seat because the actions to cause the money supply to change are done through the Empire Bank. The other 4 serve 2-year terms, rotating basis. One will be going in, a couple will be staying, one will be going out, something like that. But the Empire Bank president will always be a voting member. So the FOMC has a total of 12 members, 7 governors, 5 bank presidents. 4 of them serve on rotating basis. 1 of them is permanent. I remember I got in some political hot water in 2009. The then president of the Empire Bank was appointed to head the treasury by the incoming president. Now, I praised a lot of his actions, but I found that one to be absolutely ridiculous, because that would have been the bank president who was overseeing all those banks in New York City that had screwed up so badly that we nearly went into a financial apocalypse. And yet somehow he got rewarded by becoming the new treasury secretary. But there's that. Anyway, so keep that in mind. Remember that. Now, the bank has three jobs. Bank has three jobs. Three duties of the central bank. Its first job, I already told you about it, regulates and supervises banks. Two. This one's interesting. The Federal Reserve is a bank for banks. Banks have to put their money somewhere. A bank has to have a checking account, things like that. The Federal Reserve can do that. However, banks don't have to use the Federal Reserve. There are commercial, massive commercial banks that will also be the bank for your bank. You got a bank? You could come to me, the Fed, and I would take care of your checking accounts and all that. You'd make your deposits to me. Or you could go to this gentleman's private commercial bank. The odd thing is that the charter of the Federal Reserve requires that if you come to me, I cannot cut prices so much that I hurt you. I am in charge of doing everything I can to advance the technology of banking. And when I come up with something, I have to give it to you for free. Share it. Even at that, the Federal Reserve gives the Treasury billions of dollars in profit every year. And the interesting thing is that this public agency, the Federal Reserve, does not hurt banks like yours. The idea here is, I was writing politically so much. I said, you know, we're talking about this healthcare thing. We've got a model that's been going on for almost 100 years of a government-provided service that goes in direct competition with private services of exactly the same kind, and yet the private services are making money hand over fist, and the public one is making money hand over fist. I said, isn't this a perfect model for a health insurance system? Just have it be like the Fed's bank, commercial banking system. No one wanted to hear that. I actually asked the St. Louis guy a while, not too many, a couple of years ago. I said, how many banks use the Fed as their bank, and how many banks use the private commercial banks? He said that he couldn't tell me for the entire nation. He said, but in the St. Louis district region, about 65% of the banks use the Federal Reserve and 35% use the private commercial banks. And he said the fees are almost exactly the same at whichever one. It's just that banks just go to the big dog. That's all there is to it. But the commercial banks are making huge profits being banks for banks. So that gives you an interesting take on some of these problems we talk about. Well, it's either this or that. Universal health care provided by the government or free enterprise provided by the private health insurance companies. Here's a model. We've been doing it 100 years. Why don't you even consider this possibility? It's probably one of the most successful things the government ever did. Other than putting a man on the moon, that was pretty awesome too. Three. It conducts monetary policy. It conducts monetary policy. Oh, that one. If you were in an economics class, I would take you through how this is done. It is an awful... It's an awful lot like real heavy-duty learning. And it happens every day, day in and day out. They have three ways they can do it. One way is to change the required reserve ratio. As they set this at different levels, it actually makes the money supply grow at a faster rate or a slower rate. Now, that's a real meat axe. So the problem is that, I mean, even small changes would have dramatic shifts on the economy. I'll give you an example, and it really scares me to say this. Madam, do you remember the attacks of 9/11? Not really. It makes me really sad. I'm talking to a generation that came after those. But at the time, there was this sense that the economy was going to go tap city, because essentially we thought people were going to run the banks. We were attacked. Let's go and get our money out of the bank and put it under the mattress, kind of thing. So the Fed pushed up the required reserve ratio hard, real fast, so the banks had to have more money in their vaults in case there was a mass panic and run. Turned out there wasn't. There was nothing. And so they were able to bring it back down fairly quickly again. But the Fed probably wouldn't change the required reserve ratio to conduct monetary policy unless it was really something they needed to do dramatically. Now, the next one is that the Fed controls the discount rate. This is the rate at which the Fed lends money to member banks. You see, you can go. You're a bank. You need to borrow some money. You could go to the Fed and borrow it. And I, the Fed, would charge you the discount rate. Or you can go to a fellow bank and borrow it from them at a free market rate, which will be higher than mine. Now, I want you to think about this carefully. You need to borrow as a person. I am your father. Scares the hell out of me too, son. You are his broski, his bruh, his cuz. Yeah. Okay, now, you need $1,000 real fast. I mean, real fast. We're not going to get into why, but, you know, it was... For God's sake, what were you thinking? Oh, anyway... You can come to me and ask for the $1,000. I'll charge you a very low interest rate. Or you can go to your friend there. He'll lend you $1,000 at a higher rate. Who are you going to go to?
You.
Really? I'm an ass. I'm a monster.
It's all about the money.
Ah, you don't know what I could be like. I mean, I was such a weird father. My kids are so messed up, it's ridiculous. Think hard. Because I can see, you know what the Federal Reserve has? A giant long microscope wand. I will ask all kinds of questions, lots of questions. And you will not only have to explain why you need the $1,000, but what the hell you were doing in Tijuana to begin with, and how you got involved with that family and the lady named Lola, and why her brothers are coming up to kill you for that $1,000. Do you really want to, or you want to say to ask your friend, and he'll say, sure, brother. You understand that back in the day, they actually did, most banks did borrow from the interbank network. They borrowed at a higher rate called the federal funds rate. The Fed doesn't set that rate, but it can affect it by moving the supply and the demand of money in the banks, but they can't really set it. Well, there's a problem, of course, you see, because the Fed can set the discount rate, but it does that mostly as a signal to the, okay, we're going to move the discount rate up. That means the Fed thinks the economy is heating up too much. We're going to move it down. That means that the economy is slowing down too much, so they signal, we are going to ease up on the money supply and let you guys have a lot more money in this system. So it's more like a signal, the discount rate has been historically. And then there's the monster of the open market operations, the OMOs. This is billions and billions of dollars in open market operations every day, driven by the decision of the FOMC, and the district bank president in New York City talks to the domestic trading desk and says, this is what the FOMC has said we do today. We're going to move money out of the banking system, or we are going to move money into the banking system day in, day out, tens of billions of dollars. And that's all I have for you today. I thank you.